This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. All is not well amongst the Western hegemonic front countries as rumblings of disagreements between the U.S. and Europe have erupted into a full-blown 9.0 earthquake on the Richter scale. Now, the Munich Security Conference may become known as the site where the stake was finally driven through the heart of the U.S.-led unilateral world. From Ukraine, NATO tariffs to Greenland, the U.S. Trump administration have turned Europe upside down in less than a month after coming to power. Well, what does it all mean and where is this going? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this spotlight. Let's start off with the following report.
As the war in Ukraine rages, European leaders fear they are being pushed to the sidelines. President Trump's renewed push for direct peace talks with Russia has sent shockwaves through the EU, raising concerns that Washington is willing to cut a deal without European input.
That Ukrainians will be at the table and Europeans will be at the table.
The answer to that last question, just as you framed it, the answer is no. The answer to the earlier part of that question is yes, of course the Ukrainians are going to be at the table.
Trump calls for a quick end to the war, even if that means Kiev making territorial concessions. His approach is driving a wedge between Washington and its closest allies. And then there's NATO. Trump's recent remarks questioning America's commitment to European defense have alarmed leaders across the continent. The U.S. has hinted that European nations must increase their defense spending, something Trump has long demanded.
And we told the European Union, we told the NATO people, largely they overlap, you have to pay more money because it's unfair what we're doing. We're doing a tremendous amount more. We're probably $200 billion more going into Ukraine, using for Ukraine to fight. And Europe has not really carried its weight in terms of the money. It's not equitable.
And the divisions don't stop there. Trade relations between the U.S. and EU are once again under strain, with Trump's tariffs on European goods, from cars to agriculture, potentially as high as 20%, the EU is considering retaliatory measures, raising the risk of a full-scale trade war. Meanwhile, the old idea of a U.S. push to acquire Greenland is making a return. Though Denmark has rejected any possibility of a sale, U.S. officials see Greenland's resources and strategic location as vital to American interests. From defense commitments to industrial policies, Europe and the U.S. seem to be more at odds than ever.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Mike Billington, editor, Executive Intelligence Review out of Hamilton, USA. And John Ross, senior fellow at Chungyang Institute, Renmin University of China, out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off with Mike. I mean, Mike, Trump has rocked the hegemonic front boat in ways many never would have imagined. He's only been in office about a month. Let's look at some of the ways he has broken some of the taboos that have been set basically since the U.S. has taken control of this rules-based system.
Well, the most important upheaval actually came from his vice president, J.D. Vance, who spoke at the Munich conference the other day and quite correctly and quite powerfully and for the first time in modern history basically blasted the Europeans for the fact that they are failing at democracy. Now, that's quite interesting. There's real questions about so-called democracy in the U.S. as well. You know, Trump has been talking about silencing anyone who dares to criticize Israel. So, you know, free speech is not exactly unlimited in the United States. But what Vance had to say about Europe was absolutely true. He pointed directly at the Romania situation, where, as I'm sure you know, the EU stepped in to literally cancel an election because they didn't like the fact that the candidate who came out in front was a supporter of Russia, an opponent of the Ukrainian war. And of course, you have other countries across Europe who are also finally publicly expressing their anger at the fact that the isolation of Russia has not damaged Russia terribly. Their economy is booming, but it's undermining and destroying much of Europe. Germany is in a state of economic freefall, literally disintegrating, and yet they never lifted a finger against the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, which was bringing them cheap oil and gas from Russia. Right. And everybody knows that that was done by American intelligence networks, as Seymour Hersh proved, and yet they're tolerating it. So the situation now is for the U.S. to come in and say, you know, you're not really following free speech and democracy by undermining any any opposition forces on the right wing or the left. They've been silenced.
Okay.
And I think this is an accurate statement by Vance, and it's infuriating the Europeans because they know they're guilty. They can't really refute it.
Right. Well, definitely interesting times. I mean, John, Ukraine has been a project of Washington and Europe for decades now. And, of course, we know that the war actually started in 2022 between Ukraine and continues until now. Now, Trump says the war must end and is about to hold talks with Moscow without the EU or Kiev. What does this move mean? What signal does it or message does it send to the Europeans?
Well, what Trump's trying to do is very clear. It's what's been aptly termed a reverse Kissinger. That is, he wants to split Russia and China. Let's make what the original Kissinger was. When the United States was losing the Vietnam War, it was losing it because the combination of the Vietnamese people, China, and the Soviet Union was proving itself to be stronger than the United States. So Kissinger decided that the only way to deal with this was to try to split Russia and China using the Sino-Soviet split. And that was his whole orientation, and he duly orientated on that. And it was, from the point of view, the United States, a gigantic success. It culminated in the destruction of the Soviet Union. Now what Trump wants to do, and this is not implicit, there's lots of people in the United States who write this, is that instead what the United States has to do is to form an agreement with Russia in order to isolate China so that China, which is considered by the United States to be its strongest competitor, so that China can be dealt with in an isolated way. Then if that was done successfully, which is not at all certain, of course, the United States would then turn around and attack Russia. And the final thing which is in that is that the United States hopes it will do certain deals that the Russia will not support certain countries in the global south, so that Russia and China will abandon Iran, they will abandon Cuba, they will abandon North Korea, and so that the United States can attack them individually. It's totally transparently clear what Trump is attempting to do, and he's quite prepared to get the Europeans out of the way in order to try to carry out what is regarded as a much more serious strategy.
That's a very interesting analysis. Mike, your thoughts on what John has said, and what does it mean then in the relations with the Europeans? I mean, is this over what we have been seeing for almost 100 years, I guess, but especially after World War II? I mean, your assessment first of what John has said, and what does it mean exactly for U.S.-European relations?
Well, that is what he's saying is somewhat the British view. In fact, their efforts to divide Russia and China have been in the forefront of this. Kissinger was actually a somewhat slavish follower of Chatham House, as he himself bragged that he reported to Chatham House before he reported to the State Department, even when he was Secretary of State. But the issue of what Trump's going to do is not clear. I don't think it is obvious what he's trying to do. He, as you probably know, just yesterday or the day before, said that once he gets things cleared up with the Ukraine situation and ends this war, and he's supposed to hold a private meeting with Putin soon, and some of his people are going to be meeting with the Russian people in Saudi Arabia any day now, and this should lead to an ending of this insane conflict in Ukraine. And a restoration of sane relations between the United States and Russia. But he said that one of the first things he wants to do once that gets cleared up is to have meetings with both Putin and Xi Jinping to discuss reviving arms limitation policies, in particular to stop producing so many nuclear weapons, which, as he correctly said, we have enough to blow the world up 100 times. We don't need to keep producing them, nor does Russia, nor does China, for that matter. And he wants to hold that meeting. It has to be remembered that when Trump came in his first term, he was extremely positive about China. He invited Xi Jinping to Mar-a-Lago. He then went to Beijing, had a wonderful trip, spent a full day with Xi Jinping, getting a sort of a history lesson on the history of China and culture at the Forbidden City, and was committed to collaboration with China with some economic restraints. And he ended up getting sucked into going after China because of the COVID. And they convinced him that he had to basically blame China for the COVID. He called it the China virus and so forth, mm-hmm. in order to not be blamed himself. And that was a big mistake he made. But I'm sure that he at least would like to be able to reestablish good relations with Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. And let's hope he does. The only way that the West and the U.S. in particular are going to avoid a total economic disintegration, which is now in the works. It's in the works already in Europe, and it's threatening in the U.S. with a financial bubble unprecedented in human history, $2 quadrillion of derivative gambling debts, which is about to explode. And the only way to properly deal with that is to sit down with Russia and China, and the BRICS nations and the global South generally, and formulate a new economic policy which addresses the security and development needs of every country on the planet. Okay. So this is the only hope that he has of getting out from under the economic disintegration that's now facing the West.
Okay, well, John, I mean, why is the European political elite so adamant about continuing the war, Ukraine-Russia war? And what does it mean when the UK is saying now that it is willing to put boots on the ground in Ukraine, and at the same time we have the Trump administration saying that they're about to sit down with Russia to end this? I mean, what does all of this mean in your perspective?
Well, it means that they understand that the United States and Russia, quite rightly, regard that Western Europe is incapable of playing an independent role in world politics. It's been groveling to the United States, or going along with United States policies, ever since World War II. It can't act independently. Its talk about putting full military forces into Ukraine is pure bluff. Can't possibly put military forces in there. Sufficient to deter the Russian army. And it's found itself in a situation where its acquiescence to the United States ever since World War II has now placed it in a great, huge mess. From what the United States is doing, there's no secret. The people like Mearsheimer, for example, I quote, who's a realist politician, said he would be prepared to fight and die in order to prevent China developing. And he thinks that the United States should get out of Ukraine because he wants to make an agreement with Russia in order to isolate China to attack it. And the people who will be sacrificed in that are the West Europeans, so that they object to it. As for the arms talk, the arms proposal of Trump, they're just cynical. What he's actually proposing to do with the 50% arms reductions is to cement in place US military supremacy, because its military budget is much bigger than that of either Russia or China, so that if you have a 50% cut, what will happen is the United States will maintain its military superiority. So it's just absurd to talk about being peaceful when it's a quite cynical move. The only thing that would be reasonable would be, for example, the United States, Russia, all agreed to reduce their, say, nuclear weapons to a certain level, say 1,000 or something, and China was unable to develop themselves up to the same level. So Trump's just carrying out his attack on China, and it's not, there's no secret. All the people around him propose that, and they propose this thing for a long time thing to do. What he wants from Russia is that Russia will agree to attack that other people, including Iran, but also Cuba, Venezuela, Brazil, other countries that go
south. Well, let me just jump in here, John. I want to talk about your analysis a little bit. I mean, why would Russia agree to this? Because Russia, like so many other countries, have seen what the United States can and will do to Moscow. So why would it turn its back, for example, on Cuba, that we know from the time of the Soviet Union to now
that Moscow and Havana have very close ties, and other countries too. So why would Russia agree to something like this in your perspective?
Well, I'm not saying that it will agree. I say that that's what Trump is trying to do.
Okay.
Russia is confronted with the following situation. Trump has to offer them something substantial. It's obviously what he would offer them. He'd offer them Ukraine would not be in NATO. He will offer them that the four eastern provinces of Ukraine, either all of them or those which Russia controls apart, would become part of Russia. And there would be that the Ukrainian borders would disappear, as Hexeth said, and that the sanctions against Russia would be lifted.
Mm-hmm.
That all of which would be to the advantage of Russia. These would not be illusory gains, and Russia would have to consider, would very much like to get these things. He then hopes that Russia will accept that so that he can carry out his attacks on China and other countries.
Okay.
Or whether Russia will or not, I'm not saying. I'm saying what he's trying to do. I'm not saying what will happen.
Okay. All right. Well, Mike, it is said by some experts that what we're witnessing inside the U.S. is a tug of war between the globalists and the capitalists. I mean, your assessment of what is taking place inside of the U.S. and the type of policies that we're seeing now coming out of Washington?
Well, it's mixed. I'm not sure that characterization is the best characterization.
How would you characterize it?
The problem is that within Trump's circles, you have two totally different conflicting forces. I mean, you have three or four of the appointees, including Marco Rubio and Hegseth and others, are part of the old neocon war party, who think that the U.S. has to stick to being, you know, America first by being open and willing to go to war. And that includes the people that want to have the conflict with China, which John seems to think is Trump's policy. I don't think it is. Trump has at the same time appointed and succeeded, and we helped get Tulsi Gabbard confirmed as the new head of intelligence in the United States. The fact that the U.S. intelligence community has been so totally corrupted that we had people massively lying throughout, especially during the Biden years, but, you know, even well before that, they formulated fake stories to get us into wars against Iraq, against Libya, against Syria. They created this whole hoax about Russiagate, which now is known to be a complete farce, and yet it was used to basically drive Trump out of office and tried to prevent him from coming back in by a restoration of those silly, ridiculous lies. And yet that crew, I mean, the corrupted intelligence community, which also, of course, was weaponized in terms of their going after Trump personally and others, as they went after Lyndon LaRouche way back in the 1980s and 90s, that was really the first case of the weaponization of the FBI and the intelligence community against political leaders. And it became really outrageous in the last era, which Trump is committed to getting rid of. And he appointed Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard has, and Kash Patel, who hasn't firmly been confirmed yet, but both of them are committed to cleaning out the deep state, the corrupted permanent bureaucracy within the intelligence community, and to clean out this mess that has helped bring the U.S. to its current state of ruin.
Okay, well, John, what does this pivot out of Washington actually mean for Western alliances, such as NATO, in your perspective?
That Europe will surrender to the United States, the Western Europe, I mean. That the United States has controlled the situation in Europe ever since 1945. There's no longer any serious inter-imperialist rivalry. And Trump's calculation, which I think is entirely correct, is if he were able to do a deal with Russia, the Western European leaders would moan, groan, and then in the end they would go along with whatever the United States wants, so he can ignore them. And that's his calculation. I think that is a correct calculation of what the West Europeans would do. The problem is that in the question of the leadership of Russia, it can understand perfectly well. It's extremely intelligent. It understands what would happen, which is that it would turn that if the United States were able to defeat China, then the United States will, which is not at all certain, whatever Trump does, it's a very, very big deal because China is the most pure state of the United States. But if it were able to do so, then Trump will turn around and attack Russia, or the United States will turn around and attack Russia. Mm-hmm. That's because he made office then. And therefore they understand that. So therefore, why should they go along with this proposal? So what Trump is, therefore, Trump is trying to do, as another is the calculations which will be taking place in Russia, because the Russia also know the history of what happened with the catastrophe with the breakup of the Soviet Union. But that's what he's trying. There's a long way to go before he succeeds in this, enormous obstacles, by which I'm not predicting that he will succeed in it. Analyzing what he is attempting to do at the present time, and it's perfectly logical, and it's not even implicit. There's lots of people in the United States who write that this is what the strategy was. It was a huge mistake, in their view, to have a simultaneous conflict between the United States and Russia and China. Therefore, it's got to neutralize, as China is the main enemy, it's got to neutralize Russia, and this is what they're attempting to do. It's not secret at all.
Well, Mike, really quick, I have about a minute or so. I mean, when we look at whether we're talking about the tariffs that the United States has proposed against the Europeans or Canada, are we looking at what it says it wants to buy Greenland from Denmark? I mean, do you agree with John that a lot of this is just like bluffing or trying to pressure the Europeans to try to get a little bit more? Or your assessment of this?
Well, they're foolish policies. There's no question. The tariffs are not going to succeed in doing what he says they're going to do. His effort to take over Panama and Greenland is foolish. It's just as foolish as his crazy proposal for Gaza. The idea that the U.S. can take over Gaza and move 2 million Palestinians out of Gaza is absurd. It can't happen. There's no way it's going to happen. No Arab country is going to accept all these people, these migrants, being shoved into their country. And the Palestinians aren't going to leave. They've suffered through one of the worst genocides in history, but they're not going to leave their homeland. So it's foolish stuff. And Trump has a certain bravado that he puts forward ideas that are almost self-evidently incapable of being implemented. So you can say he's just doing this as posturing and part of his negotiations. But nonetheless, you have to tell the truth about the fact that they're foolish. They can't work the way he says they are.
All right. You know, now, that note, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. I thank both of you for being with me. Mike Billington, editor, Executive Intelligence Review out of Hamilton. John Ross, senior fellow, Chongyang Institute, Renmin University of China, out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hasan al-Askari. When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue and I'm your host Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hasan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and hardships in order to spread and promote and keep intact the high values and goals of the religion of Islam. Truly, there are so many countless favors that have been bestowed upon the Muslims by the divinely appointed Imams, the infallible and immaculate Imams, including Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. You know, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, he really lived in an era which was really suffocating. The Abbasid Empire was superficially reaching its peak, but internally and from within, we find that it was crumbling. It was breaking apart. And there's various different factors and various different variables, for example, that we find that are indicators that from within the Abbasid Empire was breaking apart. But of course, superficially, it seemed like they were at the peak of their power. Still, we find that because the Abbasid Empire knew that from within it was breaking apart and it could not sustain its empire for much longer, they came down incredibly hard upon Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam and his followers and his network of representatives in order to try to prevent them from acquiring power or trying to prevent them from taking the reins of the Muslim Ummah as the Almighty Allah had ordained for it to happen. So in one of these conversations, of course, that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam has with a companion, he says that whoever loves us will be with us in the highest position. Now, he can be talking about both in this world and the hereafter, or only the hereafter. But he says, whoever loves us will be with us in the highest position, and whoever deviates from us will be in the fire. So, based upon the second part of the statement, we can infer that the first part of the statement is also regarding the hereafter. And so whoever loves us, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, will be with us in the highest position in the hereafter, and whoever deviates from us will be in the fires of hell. Now, this is something that is, I guess, a principle for our lives, is that whoever loves the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, will be with them. But you have to understand what the true meaning of love is here. If you love somebody, you listen to them, you obey them, you follow them. And so likewise, in the same manner, if we love the Ahlul Bayt, and this is the love that they are speaking about, if you love them, then you will follow their orders, follow their commands, follow what they say, you know, which comes down to the things that are wajib, that we must do, the obligatory things, and the things that are haram, that are prohibited for us to do. Really, that is the main place where this action comes into play. The more we love them, the more we will act upon this. And of course, whoever deviates from them, which means deviates from their teachings, deviates from their guidance, which is rightly guided, divinely guided, then of course they will be in the fire. And anybody who follows those who deviate from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam will end up in the same place. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Askari alayhi as-salam. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hasan al-Askari, who was under house arrest. And it's been said that he wrote this book about the contradictions which he said exists in the Qur'an, which he claimed to be existing in the Qur'an. And when Imam Hasan al-Askari found out that he has written such a book, he said to one of his companions, "Go to Al-Kindi and greet him, and with much respect, talk to him and tell him that if someone recites the Qur'an to you, but he means something to you other than what you understand from that verse of the Qur'an, what would you say? Would you say that this is a contradiction? Would you say that it's contradictory to what is understood?" Al-Kindi said, "I doubt that you have said this yourself. Tell me who said this to you. Tell me who has made such a statement and has given such an answer." The companion of Imam Hasan al-Askari said that, "Okay, Imam Hasan al-Askari is the one who told me to say this to you." And he said, "Yes, this is right." And so it's been said that after he heard this, Al-Kindi burnt that book. And this book was about the contradictions of the Qur'an. Of course, he claimed that the Qur'an has contradictions in it. And when he learned that Imam Hasan al-Askari made such a nice, rational argument against him, he learned that he was wrong and there is no contradiction in the Qur'an. So this shows that even our infallible imams, they thought philosophically and they used reason to answer the questions and to clear up the doubts of people.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
sleepless night, my window broke, my olive tree went up in smoke. I heard the children scream, I heard the war drum beat, gunpowder in the air, dead bodies on the street. It won't take long for the dark clouds to go, for the sun to come out and shine on my home. They wave their flag in blue and white, erected walls in broad daylight.
The limelight.
The European Union has approved a grant worth almost $1 million to a firm headed by Gadi Eisenkot, one of the Israeli regime politicians who has overseen the Gaza genocide. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Storage Drop, as Eisenkot's firm is called, is taking part in Hydrocool, an EU-funded project ostensibly designed to reduce the environmental impact of air conditioning. Eisenkot is unconvincing as a champion of ecological sustainability. From October 2023 to June last year, he was part of the war cabinet which managed a genocide in Gaza. The war cabinet authorized tactics that involved routine massacres and the obliteration of civilian infrastructure. Giving Eisenkot's firm a role in a supposedly climate-friendly project like Hydrocool doesn't offset the responsibility he and his war cabinet colleagues bear for wrecking the water and sewage treatment network in Gaza. Although he is depicted as a moderate by some media outlet, Eisenkot has a history of advocating extreme violence. He was among a coterie of military commanders who devised the so-called Zahiye Doctrine, which refers to the Beirut suburb where the Zionist regime caused massive devastation during its 2006 attack on Lebanon. In October 2008, Eisenkot issued a warning to every area in which the Zionist regime encountered resistance. He said, "What happened in the Zahiye quarter of Beirut in 2006 will happen in every village from which Israel is fired on. We will apply disproportionate force on it and cause great damage and destruction there. From our standpoint, these are not civilian villages. They are military bases." The plan, he summarized, was implemented soon afterwards, when the Zionist regime launched a major offensive against Gaza in December 2008. In keeping with the Zahiye Doctrine, the Zionist regime has subsequently visited great damage and destruction against Palestinian and Lebanese villages, towns and cities on a number of occasions. Eisenkot's storage drop is the biggest recipient of EU funding under the Hydrocool project, which runs until 2027. It is, of course, inexcusable that Brussels officials should rubber stamp a grant to a firm led by a man directly culpable of Gaza's destruction. By doing so, the EU is negating its declared support for the International Court of Justice, which in January 2028 deemed the case South Africa has brought against Israel plausible. South Africa contends that the Zionist regime is violating the Genocide Convention, a cornerstone of international law drawn up following the Holocaust. That convention places on an onus on governments and governmental bodies around the world not to abet crimes against humanity. The Electronic Intifada contacted the European Commission, the EU's executive, asking why it has approved funding to a firm involving a key participant in a genocidal war. The European Commission did not answer that question. A spokesperson just replied that Horizon Europe, the EU's scientific research program, does not fund projects with a military character. The spokesperson added, "Several mechanisms are in place to prevent that EU funds are misused for activities in breach of international law. No matter how many such mechanisms might be in place, the Brussels bureaucracy has demonstrably aided a firm led by Gadi Eisenkot, a strategist of genocide. The European Union kept on exploring the possibility of deeper relations with Israel while that regime committed a genocide." A readout from discussions held last year praised the excellent performance of Israeli regime companies and institutions in Horizon Europe, the EU's scientific research program. Those discussions took place during a period when students in many countries were resorting to direct action against the Gaza genocide. Ireland's University of Galway responded to student protest with a pledge that its dealings with Israeli counterparts would be reviewed. Despite that commitment, the University of Galway is coordinating a new EU-funded project on integrating seawater treatment and green hydrogen production. It will be leading a consortium that also includes the Technion, Israel's Institute of Technology. The Technion works with the Zionist regime's arms industry on developing new machines for attacking Palestinians. As Maya Wind notes in her book Towers of Ivory and Steel, the Technion has gone so far as to explicitly offer courses on arms and security marketing and export. Its close links to Israel's top weapons maker Elbit Systems was recognized in the recent past when Bezalel Makils, the firm's CEO, was awarded the title Guardian of the Technion. During the Gaza genocide, the Zionist regime used artificial intelligence to select targets for attacks in which large numbers of civilians have been killed. Reports on such a sinister application of robotics do not seem to have prompted much soul-searching in Brussels. The EU has allocated $1.5 million to a new AI research project run by the Technion. As well as benefiting from research cooperation, the Zionist regime has long been active in the Enterprise Europe Network, a support scheme for small and medium-sized companies. The network is essentially a corporate dating agency. Playing Cupid, the European Union helps firms in their quest for marketing partners. A search of the network's database shows that it is assisting an unnamed Israeli company which offers military-grade surveillance technology. The Israeli regime firm is, according to the network, hoping its products could be installed in energy projects and prisons abroad. As Anthony Lowenstein documents in his book and film The Palestine Laboratory, Israel is adept at finding export opportunities for weapons and spying equipment tested in the context of an occupation.